Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us in studio today is Lee Hilliard, who is the Regional Gender and Protection Advisor for Southern Africa for the World Food Programme, as well as Patricia Colbert, who is a Senior Gender Advisor from UN World Food Programme, and she's based in Italy. It's wonderful to have you both here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kicking off, for the past 17 years, Patricia Colbert has worked on providing policy support, research, training, and capacity building for gender-sensitive humanitarian responses, disaster risk management, gender and livelihoods, gender and food and nutrition security, and national resources management. During this period, she has contributed to the development of various methodologies, tools for policy and program analysis from the perspectives of socioeconomics, gender, and population concerns for the World Food Programme of the United Nations, where she currently works. Can you please share with us a few of the landmarks in your career and what has impacted on you the most?
Well, that's a kind of a tall order, but I'll try and pick some highlights. I think the most interesting thing for me to date has been working mostly on food security, agricultural development and nutrition from a development perspective. When I moved into working in the last 5 to 6 years on emergency issues such as disaster risk management, disaster risk reduction, gender in emergencies, for me the thing that has struck me over the years is that I wonder why there has been such a separation between the two. The reason I say that is because I believe, in my experience of working within the UN system, that we're coming more and more to the realization that you can't separate what we try to achieve in terms of gender equality in the development arena from what we try to achieve in responding to humanitarian crises. What do I mean by that? The gains or the strides that we make in advancing equal rights for men and women in terms of access to services, access to better production means within agriculture, etc. They can't be, you know, imagined to stand still in a community that is hit by either a climatic crisis or by a political crisis. That those gains can actually be set back when a crisis occurs and you can find people reverting to their kind of traditional ways of behaviour. I think this is not peculiar to developing countries. I think we can see the same in the history of the so-called developed world as well.
Well, I think it's a humankind factor that we go back to what we know. And when a crisis arises, it is chaotic and people revert to what they were doing previously.
Yeah. And I think that sort of everybody looks for their comfort zone as well. It's a natural human instinct, as you say, that we kind of like, well, when you're in crisis, you try to create a sense of normality as quickly as possible. So I think from our perspective within the UN, when we respond, we need to be mindful of those things. One of the landmarks for me is that we certainly need to go in with no assumptions, that people understand where we're coming from, why we necessarily target women, particularly pregnant women and women who are breastfeeding, because they have different nutritional needs perhaps to other members of the community. We also try to look at age issues. If I can explain a little bit about the kind of principles that guide our gender
work. Please do.
We believe that there are universal determinants of whether you're seen or unseen. And those universal determinants at a minimum are your age, but more importantly, your sex. If you're male or you're female, if you're young, old, you will have different opportunities, you will have different expectations even within your own psyche of what the world has to offer you, and you will also have different visibility. If I'm a landless male, I'm as voiceless and as invisible perhaps as my female counterpart. So I think these are all of the things that we're looking at. I want to give a specific example. You know, in many countries where I have worked, one of the unpaid tasks that very often falls on the shoulders of women and girls is the collection of water for household needs. And in one country where I worked, there was a situation where the nearest water point was about 10 kilometres from the villages where the majority of the population had settled. This was a coastal area, so you can imagine freshwater sources were much further inland. The women having to walk 10 kilometres a day in the mornings to collect the water before they'd even consumed any food and were able to sort of provide food for their family. So you can imagine the amount of time that that takes before you even start to do any kind
of... Well, it starts the day. You need water to start the day.
Yeah. So there was a very well-intentioned NGO that decided this was a big issue. But they thought, you know, they didn't want to upset the status quo in the community because it was a very traditional community where men had certain roles and women others. So they decided one way to combat this was to provide the men with bicycles, because it was a very traditional community and it was unseemly for women to be seen on a bicycle. And they didn't feel comfortable either, because they all wore very long skirts, but you could see their legs if they were riding the bicycle. So we said, okay, we give the bicycles to the men. The idea being, of course, that the men would then go fetch the water and bring the water back a lot more swiftly. But they didn't factor in the point that men didn't even see this. This was an invisible thing for them. They didn't realise that this was such a heavy burden for the women. The NGO didn't do its homework properly. So what they ended up with was a situation where the men decided that this was a new livelihood for them. They purchased large barrels, which they would load up onto the back of the bicycles, come out and compete with the women at the well to get the water, and then they would load up the barrels and bring them in and sell them to businesses in town. So, if you like, instead of this project which set out to reduce the drudgery of women's work, it actually had the opposite.
The community.
It had the opposite effect. And that has always stuck in my mind as one of those things. I think, you know, nobody sets out to do bad projects, but if you don't really talk to the men and women in the community and explain what it is that you're trying to do by introducing these bicycles, by saying, you know, this job is really heavy duty for the women, if you don't have that dialogue with the men and the women, you're not going to achieve anything.
Every stakeholder needs to be involved when you're doing projects like that.
Yeah.
Talking about the differences between men and women, I know that one of the things that the World Food Programme does, you've got a school feeding project which aims to provide girls in certain countries with a greater chance to access education opportunities, which they might not normally have due to, as you've mentioned, the various labour demands that is part of their cultural duties. And also with the patriarchal societies, the fact that education of girls is seen as a lower priority. The advantage of having girls receive at least one full meal a day and thus relieving some of the burden upon her family in many cases trumps the more traditional notion of girls in society. Can you share some of the issues behind that particular project?
You've described pretty well what some of the issues already are. No tradition is 100% brilliant. No tradition is 100% bad.
We live in an evolving world.
Exactly.
And things have to change. I think that tradition is fundamentally important in terms of your culture. Yeah. But there are aspects which can complement and move forwards and not deny people because of a tradition.
Yeah. You have to look at it as well, I think, in terms of economic opportunity. I know it's awful to come back always to economics, but this is the thing that counts. I'm diverting slightly to come back to the subject of the school feeding programme. You mentioned the traditional roles of girls and women in mostly rural communities. If you look at the work burden of both men and women, because I don't think, you know, the thing that always strikes me about this, we always talk about women in a silo and girls in a silo, which I think is a really wrong thing to do. It's not as if you've got these isolated poor women who are married to fantastically rich men. They're living in poor households where the men are as poor as them. It's just that disadvantages sometimes weigh against women because of the burden of what we call their domestic role, and that is usually unpaid for. And we know in all of our societies what generates money is given more respect and more value and is featured.
It's the same as what gets measured is what gets the attention.
Exactly.
And you can't measure the unpaid labour.
Yeah. But these roles and responsibilities, I mean, I think sometimes we tend to think that, you know, it's always visited only by the patriarchy, but people want to belong to a community. And sometimes some of those harmful traditions are actually continued by women as well. So I think we need to balance how we look at these things. And this is my personal opinion, not that of my organisation. But the purpose of the school feeding programme is to close some of those gaps and to provide either take-home rations to girls and boys so that their family doesn't miss the contribution that they would make in terms of providing agricultural labour. That would be a means of assuring the family that as long as their children were in school, they would receive these rations that would alleviate some of the pressure on them to find that food elsewhere. One of the things that the school feeding project also tries to do is to provide hot meals at school, at least either breakfast or lunch, to provide opportunities for those children who do come to school to encourage them to continue attending because at least there's something there. And that also involves usually women in the communities who come to prepare the food. I think I'll ask Lee to speak to this one.
Sure. I would like to just start in terms of how we came to realise just what the contribution of women was to our school feeding program. At the end of last year, the Rome HQ started a program with the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex University and WFP looking at, basically the program was called Gender Innovations in the Field, and it aimed to look at how WFP was successfully mainstreaming gender in our projects. So we had two countries in our region that had a look at how we were doing gender, what we were doing well, what we weren't doing well, and what the organization could learn as a whole in terms of improving that. So we had some country visits and some field visits, and what we realized when we did a quick calculation is that in our school feeding program, the majority of the what we call the parents' committees who help with the preparation of food were composed of women, because food is traditionally seen as the, you know, a woman's role, and so even though we wanted to include men, because of the nature of what the preparation was, we weren't getting them. Women were preparing all the food and collection of firewood, water, etc. So we did a small calculation and we realized that in one particular country, if we were to pay women for their labor that we were using voluntarily at the school, it would cost us an extra $500,000 a year. So the contribution of those women was $500,000 a year to our programs, which is not a small number by any means. So what we realized is we didn't have the money, we didn't have the extra funding to pay these women, but we did have opportunities to recognize that labor and that contribution. So taking an example that was developed by ActionAid, which is an NGO, which looked at unpaid care work related to in the home, we adapted a little bit. We called it the three R's, which is recognize, redistribute, and reduce. So one of the things that we did was a very small attempt to recognize women's labor, and that was about giving them certificates of appreciation at the schools. So there was a small ceremony at some schools where these women, these cooks, were presented with a certificate by our country director in one instance, our regional director another, and government officials. And the impact of such a small thing is really remarkable, because these women in their entire lives have never been given any sort of recognition for their work, let alone a certificate which they can put in their houses. The result was that the community actually now recognized, well, this was a really big thing for them. This tiny little piece of paper had such an impact on even the self-esteem of those women who were working at least, you know, 8 hours a day to prepare food.
How many countries is the project active in?
The school feeding program is in many, many countries. We don't have a precise figure at the moment because that fluctuates a little bit. Sometimes the program is run jointly with the government as much as possible, actually. And then sometimes they take over the school feeding programs. I think we need to probably explain a little bit about how the World Food Program works. We don't have core funding. We have no guaranteed funding from one year to the next. Every piece of funding that we get is on a voluntary basis.
So do you then go out to seek funding from other organisations or the private sector?
We have some private sector funding, but most of our funding comes from the donor communities. And we are supported ostensibly because of the amount of emergency work that we do. And for the school feeding programme, I can say that we look for multilateral funding, a multi-year funding, and then also voluntary funding. The countries that are most interested in promoting education for girls are Norway, Germany, the US, Canada, and a number of other large, shall we say, donor countries. But they're the ones who consistently fund this. And then we work also with government, and where feasible, they provide also funding for this.
And that element is so critical because you want something that's going to be sustainable. You can't start something that people are looking forward to, that people depend upon, and then have the funding to stop and the project to dissipate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so.
I think in many countries we work very closely with the government as a key partner, especially on school feeding. So the idea is that, you know, we don't intend to be delivering school feeding forever. We want to hand those processes over to the government and to make it part of their systems. So part of our work is capacitating governments to actually take up these programs. And in a lot of countries, governments are actually leading the way in this and are really taking the lead, and we provide just technical capacity building on those types of issues.
That's a great development. Yeah. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, this is Lyra, South African Afro-soul singer and songwriter. You're listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy.
Today we're talking to Patricia Colbert, Senior Gender Advisor from the United Nations World Food Programme, as well as Lee Hilliard, who is the Regional Gender and Protection Advisor for Southern Africa, also part of the UN World Food Programme. In our previous segment, we were talking about the burden that women bear in terms of being able to provide food, particularly from the school programs and the support that they provide in that space. I understand that one of the projects that you're working on, there was a pilot, the Purchase for Progress, which allowed the World Food Programme to test new ways in terms of leveraging its purchasing power to support agriculture as well as market development in developing countries. And on your website, it indicates that over the last 5 years, the pilot has transformed the lives of thousands of farmers, especially women, in 20 developing countries, supporting them to grow more, to sell more, and commercially earn more. And I know that we mentioned that economics was a very important part in any society. Can you tell us a bit more about the project and particularly how it benefits women?
Okay. I think you've already mentioned what the overall objective of the project was. I think that we need to say that we're the world's biggest food assistance UN organization globally. So we buy quite a lot of our food in developing countries. One of the main objectives behind this approach was to encourage purchase from smallholder farmers. The reason being that also we don't want to skew the local market, because, you know, sometimes when there is a crisis and there has to be a bulk food assistance operation, you can create huge imbalances on the local market and send the price of local food either plummeting or soaring to the sky. But I think in terms of the actual men and women that we target through the project, the idea is to make sure that they improve their production by giving them access to improved seeds, fertilizers, training on management, on negotiating contracts, also building self-esteem. Because a lot of the work in the P4P, which is Purchase for Progress project, is through farmers' organizations. Traditionally, in many of the countries where we ran the pilot, it's not usual to see women as members, because they usually are in what we call the food crop production side of things, that is for home consumption. The role that they play in cash crop production is usually relegated under what we call family labour. So they don't have traditionally a role in farmers' organisations. So one of the big lessons that we learnt from this pilot process in terms of trying to empower women, I'll give you my personal opinion on that in a minute, not the opinion of the organisation, we found that if you didn't involve men in the dialogue about this, the leadership on and also try to involve men in encouraging women to participate better, training them also in self-esteem so that they could actually voice their opinions, we found that that was one of the big successes. Because it's not about numbers. It's not about increasing the numbers of women involved or participating in the project. It's more about building the skill set that they need to be able to manage that role themselves.
That's the empowering element, where they can take a venture forward.
Yeah, but if I may, on the empowering side of things, this is my personal opinion and built on my career in working on gender, we have a tendency to think that our most vulnerable are always women. I think for me, gender goes beyond looking at women. It's understanding people. It's about men, women, girls and boys of different ages. And it's about understanding how we manage and negotiate our roles and responsibilities. And I say our because we're different people with different people. And for me, one of the most important lessons I've learned over the last 17, 18 years is that talking about empowering people, I'm not sure if you can empower another human being. It's something I feel that comes from inside. And the role that an outsider can play in that is giving people the skills and the knowledge to make informed decisions, whatever those decisions are. That's what empowering is having a choice. And also the other side of that equation is that talking about giving power to another person is not a zero-sum game. To give power to women, you have to take power from men. And I'm not saying that that is not desirable. I'm just saying that to do that in a siloed way where you're just concentrating and saying we're empowering women without involving men in the process and explaining also to them, I don't know how far you're going to be able to advance.
I agree with your perspective. Everything in life is a dynamic, and when you put into an action, there's a corresponding reaction.
Yes.
So, you know, people have to be satisfied with both measures, which is why it's so vital to have the dual dialoguing.
Yeah.
With these projects, there is an incredible investment of resource that goes into them. For instance, with the Purchase for Progress pilot, how successful has this been? And can you share some of the statistics or specific learnings?
There were a lot of people targeted by the project. There have been a number of evaluations of this project. After 2 years of a pilot, the first evaluation said that there needed to be more women, and there was a whole gender strategy put into place that tried to target women as well and looked at the specificities of the context in which we were operating and tried to bring them on board. I think overall the final figures are in excess of, I think, 600,000 people who were involved in the 20 pilot countries. And for the way forward, I know that it has captured the hearts and minds of many governments who see this as a good way forward, and that was one of the objectives, to hopefully have this taken up by governments and also by perhaps private sector investors to encourage them to purchase directly from smallholder farmers or farmers' organisations. I just want to go back to some of the highlights on the lessons learnt vis-a-vis women's involvement. And I think that, yes, this has been incredible in strengthening farmers' organisations and giving women a meaningful and active role in farmers' organisations. But this has taken a lot of negotiation also with men and a lot of interaction, gender training for both men and women. And a lot of the work on gender within the P4P, which we refer to it as in shorthand, is overcoming cultural norms that limit women's access to land and to agricultural inputs.
And I think that's a really important factor. I read recently that with the African Union, they're trying to increase the land ownership of women across the continent to have 30%, which I think is still a small number. But it goes by stating how much of the ratio falls into males' capacity on land.
I think we need to sort of look at those figures globally. If you look at women's land ownership globally, the figures would come in at something like 5, 6%. So I think that in participating nations in Africa, you can reach 30%. I think that that's a fantastic goal. But I think we need to not stop there. The only reason I think that we are insisting so much on looking at land ownership and land tenure is, you know, sometimes women particularly, we usually find out that they're the ones with the smallest plots of land, the ones who usually have the greatest disadvantage. In terms of agricultural land ownership and things like that, we know that if you don't own a piece of land, you don't have collateral, you cannot get access to credit. The credit that you can then pour back into your agricultural production, either improving your seed purchase, your fertilizer purchase, actually buying machinery, which is usually out of the reach of women farmers because they're usually working on very, very small plots of land.
Finance is a crucial means to accessing resources and being able to advance them, and that really is what life's all about, of being able to move forwards. But if you don't have the financial means to do so, it becomes crippling.
And I think the biggest challenge that we face is that, you know, I mean, for example, if you do have some collateral, it makes a difference. People see you as a valid person for a loan. And I know that many, many efforts over the years have been invested into what we call microcredit projects, which are pretty good. But for me, the ultimate, and then again, I'm speaking for myself, I see that these microfinance projects need, and they often are accompanied by literacy, basic numeracy, management, awareness raising, etc. And these are vital because for me, these microcredit projects will only work when people can move from the microcredit sector into the mainstream credit sector. And that requires, obviously, having viable collateral to move forward.
I think one of the most important things that have come out of what you've said is the need to integrate between the various stakeholders, the need to look at every situation as an individual situation mm-hmm. and assess what the context is, and being able to have that flexibility. And quite often people have a fixed mindset when they go into looking and reviewing situations and want to pigeonhole things into nice little boxes and silos. But the reality is the world's not like that. It is dynamic, and in order to be effective, it requires that flexibility.
You know, I often think about it in terms of as well, you know, sort of, it's life, it's humankind. We like to pigeonhole people. But the great thing about, for me, after all these years of working on gender issues, I still am very, 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 very confident that things will change, because human relations are complicated. We need to take that in mind as well when we're working as responders, and understand that it's not one size fits all. So for us, it's really important that you don't go in assuming I know who are the most vulnerable.
Assumption is a big risk. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Yvonne Chakachaka, and I'm UNICEF and Rollback Malaria Goodwill Ambassador. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in the struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy. A program against social ills such as racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence. Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Balka every week on this day at this time.
Today we're talking to Patricia Colbert, Senior Gender Advisor from UN World Food Programme, and Lee Hilliard, who is the Regional Gender and Protection Advisor for Southern Africa. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. Now, continuing with our discussion, in the previous segment, we were talking about land ownership, and one of the things you've mentioned was that approximately 5 to 6% of land ownership the world over on a global level is controlled by women. But talking from the African Union point of view, that they're wanting to try to increase this ratio up to 30%, which is significant. And I think that African countries really should be commended for the efforts that they've gone through to in terms of pursuing gender issues. And increasingly, the number of women occupying positions in government and heads of state is growing. And I consider this trend to be significant for several reasons. Firstly, in terms of demonstrating empowerment of women in governance. Secondly, women in these positions are able to serve as role models for other women. And thirdly, having suitable gender representation is important in terms of policy development and policy implementation. And I think part of that goes back to what we were talking about previously, about that dialoguing and being able to have a representation of women in the right space.
In many, many instances, you're streets ahead of the so-called developed countries. You know, I mean, I'm thinking about government representation and even private industry representation on the boards of many of the private sector companies. You don't have the women's representation that is desirable. Women work now in many instances as much as men in the private sector, in agriculture, and their voice needs to be heard, because we have acknowledged that women and men have different priorities, they have different needs that are linked to their roles in their communities or even outside of their households, and within their households, I should say. So representation in government is a really important thing. And it's, for me, one of the significant things that you've also mentioned is about role modelling. I think that, you know, if you can't aspire to do certain things unless you see others do it. I'm not saying that there aren't pathfinders and there haven't always been those, that small percentage of innovators who've always managed to come out ahead. But for the ordinary Joe Soaps like myself, or should I say Josephine Soaps like myself, you need the inspiration of seeing others doing it before you. That's why I would believe that tying it back to sort of a women's representation, either in local government or national government or global representation, is really, really important. And that's something that we're trying to address within the World Food Programme as well. At the moment, we're working very hard on trying to look at gender parity within our own upper echelons of management, because we believe that we have to walk the talk. We can't say to national governments, hey, you don't have enough women's representation. As an organisation, we're saying we need to show that women are decision makers as well within our own organisation. I mean, a country like Rwanda, it's the only country in the world that has 50% representation of women.
Well, they rank in terms of first in the world with regards to women's representation.
Yeah.
And Senegal is eighth.
Yeah.
South Africa at the moment is 10th. But then when we look to countries like the US, I think they are, what are they, USA is only 85th, the UK 65th, and France is 48th. And I look at this and go, well, it really begs the question of how we can allow such low representation in the developed world.
Mm-hmm.
And given your experience and the work that you've done in the last 18-odd years with gender issues, and particularly with women, and also with the organization that continues to pursue gender equality, what's your point of view on these differences?
Well, it can't be tackled just from one side. Now I'm going to go into my own sort of sphere and slightly get on my little soapbox. So this is not the opinion of my organization, but for me, I certainly think that we need to look more at power and privilege in terms of looking at representation in government, because we say that there are equal opportunities for representation, but there are many things in the world that still remain male bastions. And yes, I know I sound like a feminist. I am a feminist. I believe that, and feminist from the point of view of believing that there should be equal opportunities for both women and men, because it's only by equal representation that we will really understand and have a world that actually works, where the burden of going out there and earning the money doesn't lie exclusively with men, and that the burden of raising children and looking after the household doesn't always lay with women. Again, this is going back to the discussion we had earlier about empowerment. I'm not saying that we should look down on people who choose to stay at home and look after their children. That, for me, is part of the empowerment process. You have a choice, but this is the choice that you've made, and that has to be respected as well. But as to political representation, I think that there are unspoken barriers that still exist, and I think we're a long way from people feeling comfortable. For me, a thing that I was personally offended by a couple of years back was when Christine Lagarde became the head of the IMF. You look at how the media represents female politicians, people who are in major sort of spotlight, like somebody like Christine Lagarde. What were the comments on her? How elegant and how pretty she was, and for a woman of her age, how beautifully dressed
that
she was.
That reminds me of a statement, and I'm sorry to interject here, of Hillary Clinton was interviewed, and one of the questions that they asked her was, where did she buy her outfit from?
Mm-hmm.
And she responded, is that a question that you would have asked a man?
Yeah. Do you ever hear men described that way? Going back to the Hillary Clinton examples, another very offensive moment was when her daughter announced that she was having her first baby, which should be a very happy moment for any family. The political pundits in the US started to say, oh, now, you know, will Hillary now withdraw from the race? Because after all, as a grandmother, I think the only person who made sense but made a laugh out of it was one of those political satirists on TV. He said, did anybody ask the same questions about Mitt Romney, who happens to be a grandfather 50 times? Within political circles, we still think that women can't have it all. And if you look at the percentage of representation, even among politicians or women in big business, they're not afforded the luxury of having a family life. If they're usually out there in the front, it's an either-or situation, whereas the same rules don't usually apply to men. again, as I said, this is all of my personal opinion. I'm not despairing. I think that there's a lot of awareness about that. But in a world where men who choose to stay at home are kind of looked on as sissies, I think this is a global expectation that men are supposed to be more aggressively out there, that they're not supposed to cry, they're not supposed to be too lovey-dovey about their children or their families, that that's still the domain of women. And I think that sometimes is also something that is encouraged by women to do certain things. We usually have a tendency to think of politicians as male. And we expect female politicians, they have to work, I believe, twice as hard often to attain the same respect that is automatically afforded to men in a similar position.
I think that you've raised really valid points there, particularly in terms of gender perceptions that we have on the political sphere and how that impacts with the rest of the landscape. Mm-hmm. We are running out of time. It's been such a pleasure to be talking to you. I'd like to just end with two last questions. One, Lee, from your perspective, as you'd be aware, being in South Africa, that every year in August we celebrate Women's Month. I feel that our history defines our present, and our present is what directs our future. In your opinion, which areas do you think that we still need to build on the most for women in the future?
I think for me, it's about understanding a common cause between men and women. And really understanding that men can be key stakeholders in the emancipation of women and our empowerment. I would say it's about understanding your fellow women, that you might have been raised in a very privileged area, but your struggles are very similar as a woman to women who come from rural areas. And I'd like to just give a personal perspective on this. I was privileged enough to work in Malawi for several years, and one of the places that I worked was the Dzaleka refugee camp. And I met a woman called Marie, who was a DRC refugee. Her husband was murdered during the war, and she fled with her two children. And I remember it was this time last year, I was sitting in her house and we were having a discussion about issues of gender-based violence. So it was a very sort of sensitive topic and a very emotional one. And there was this moment where I came to realize that, you know, Marie was exactly the same age as me. And I looked at this woman who appeared to be 50 years old, who had the most incredible life. And there was this moment when I realized, you know, that could have been me, but for an accident of birth and thousands of miles away. We were both women in that moment, and I really came to understand that there was this obligation, or I felt like I had an obligation to make sure that I did the best to allow women like Marie and other women who are in that position to experience the freedoms that I've had in my life. And so I think for women in South Africa and across Africa, it's just to realize that we're all women, and we all have the opportunity to raise each other up together. So that would be my message.
And Trish, from your perspective, I can see you're incredibly passionate in terms of the gender issues and having been in the business for as long as you have. In closing our discussion, what statements or a word of hope would you like to pass on to women who are listening to the show?
I think that I'd like to echo what Lee has said. I think that, you know, we need to be mindful of our sisterhood. We are sisters across the world. But I also think that we can't do it alone. Men have to be part of the equation. Otherwise, those very deep ingrained inequalities and opportunity that many of us are blind to, we're blind as women and men are blind to it as well, that we need to work together. So I think this is a win-win situation if we club together and have that dialogue, because you only can move forward when we have given each other the opportunity to walk in each other's shoes for even a brief few moments, to understand what it is to live life through the eyes of a man, through the eyes of a woman, and within the context in which we live. None of us choose to be born where we're born. None of us choose to be disadvantaged or advantaged. But it's very difficult to move over when you're comfortable. So it has to be done through diplomacy, and also to say that we can, if we work together, really lift each other up, because society needs fully functional and fully accountable and contributing men and women. Thank you.
Thank you for your important message and for joining us today. We'd love to hear more from you in the future with the next set of developments with the World Food Programme, particularly its gender work. You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, and we have been talking to Patricia Colbert, Senior Gender Advisor from the United Nations World Food Programme, and Lee Hilliard, the Regional Gender and Protection Advisor of UN World Food Programme in Southern Africa. Tune into the show next week when we speak to multi-award winning singer and performer Dr. Sibongile Khumalo.